Listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there. Goodness me, I've got that right. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next hour we're going to be talking about all things food. We're going to be talking about all things food statistics, actually. And with me I have Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs, and your first lot of research has just come out literally today, hasn't it?
It has.
And we're going to spend a whole programme talking about some of the stuff that's coming out, because it's just incredibly interesting. In order to do that, I am joined by Guy. I'm having trouble with my words this morning, I don't know why. Guy Routledge of Sapling Digital, and also he's co-founder of The Food Rush. And it's my great pleasure to welcome Carolyn Steele, who's author of Hungry City. We're still waiting for your next book, Carolyn, by the way. So thank you for joining us.
Well, you're keeping me from it.
Yes, well, I know that. Sorry about that. But it's important we have somebody brainy and well-read and who really understands this stuff to comment, I think, don't you?
It's
very, very, very helpful.
And why am I here then?
Why am I here? I was just thinking that, especially when I can't get my words out properly. Ollie, before we start, can you just explain what this research is and you know, the methodology of it? And also, this is research about foodies. It's not about the whole population. So if you could explain what that definition of a foodie is, that'd be great.
Of course. So we did our first big piece of research in 2017, where what we tried to understand was the state of food in the UK. And we worked with a third-party research company called SSI to essentially ask a whole load of questions. And the objective of that research in 2017 was to try and essentially segment the UK based on their attitudes to food and cooking and purchasing. And out of that research we did in 2017, we created three profiles. One was a committed foodie, one was a weekend foodie, and the other one was a home cook. And essentially, we identified those profiles based upon a series of statements we came up with about cooking from scratch, being a trendsetter, understanding, you know, what
liking novelty and food,
exactly.
You know, trying new things.
Whole series of statements. And essentially, you were put into different segments depending on how many of those statements you strongly agreed with. So we made sure these were kind of beliefs people held quite strongly. And the way it turned out was that basically 30% of the UK was what we call foodies.
Which is higher than you would think, most people would think, anyway.
And you know, when we set up Great British Chefs, which specifically is a business designed to target foodies and inspire foodies to cook interesting stuff, we didn't realise how big that market was. Mm. So what was interesting was we've just redone the research a year later, and we ran it in January. We've just published the report. And actually, we ended up changing the methodology slightly this time round to actually make it harder to be a committed foodie and harder to be a weekend foodie, because more people in the UK were agreeing with these statements, right? So historically, it was agree with 4+. We've now made a committed foodie 5+.
So you put it, you've hired the bar.
Exactly.
Sometimes.
So yeah. We still stuck it. Before, it was 32% was foodies. We've actually kept that percentage, but we've made it harder to be in the two groups because we want to sort of make sure we're really focusing in on that. Mm. And what we've tried to do is look at a whole range of different statements, ranging from where people are shopping, you know, local shops, supermarkets, online, through to views on Brexit, government regulation, what they're eating, what they're not eating, cuisines cooked at home. It's a wealth of data. And it's a national sample of 3,000 people. So it's pretty robust.
Yeah, very robust. And
then we've also done a similar, well, exactly the same piece of research with our audience, where we've had 5,000 respondents. And we've then weighted that based on our Google Analytics profile and made that representative with our audience. So we have basically two samples side by side. One is a really intensive food audience, which is our audience, and then the national sample of 3,000 people.
So it's cross-reference, so it's a really good piece of research. And the interesting thing for me is it's showing us how things are moving. I'm always more interested in trends than what people actually say. I think that's very interesting. So if you're a brand, or if you're in government, or if you're planning, or if you're doing all sorts of things, or you're in any way involved in the world of food, this is amazing data in order for you to see where things are going, isn't it? Just out of interest.
Absolutely. I mean, look, you know, we spend our time trying to address Britain's foodie and inspire Britain's foodie. So a lot of these trends are helping us make sure that the content we're creating, be that recipes or articles, or instructional videos are aligned with people's attitudes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's great to be able to see last year's numbers and now this year's and kind of start to see where those trends are going.
Yeah.
And I guess that will only continue to be beneficial as you do this. I'm assuming you're planning to do it year after year.
Yeah, and we're trying to sort of carve out different areas. We'll probably do another dip in the summer to sort of see where things are on some of the trends, but we'll probably also pick up some other things that we haven't touched on, because the problem with every piece of research is you do it and you go, oh, I wish I'd asked about that. And you're like, didn't we talk about that? And somehow it slipped through. It's always the way.
So before we move on to some of the detail of that, Carolyn, are you surprised by the number of people who classify themselves as foodies? Because those statements are quite strong statements, and to agree with five or more is really interesting.
I was surprised and delighted, because I think that's a really positive sign. I mean, it is interesting that, you know, when you have a very strong cultural trend, very often you start to get a sort of quite strong counter trend, you know, and I would say that, you know, of all the nations in the world, probably Britain is the sort of, I would say, second most industrialised food nation after the United States. And of course, we kind of co-invented industrial food. So if you experience, shall we say, the extremes of an industrial food model, then it's inevitable that someone is going to kind of say, I don't like the way this is going, and start to invent plan B. So,
but a third is a lot.
It's higher than I would have thought.
It's just under a third. It's 30%. So essentially, committed foodies are 17%. Weekend foodies are 13. So you've got the 17% who are really at the kind of driving this, and there's 13%.
And in terms of numbers in the UK, we're talking about adults, aren't we? Yeah. How many are we talking about?
So the way we model is each percentage is 450,000.
Right.
So to the 45 million population of 18 to 74. So basically, the 17% of committed foodies represent about 7.6 million people.
That's a lot of people. It's a big market. Yeah. And hopefully, if we can harness that, that's a very influential market.
I mean, I think before we get too excited about it, you know, there is the flip of it, which is, you know, 11% of the UK claim to never chop vegetables. So, you know,
that's also worryingly high, and
one of the other stats, which again worries me deeply, is that 25% never chop fresh herbs. Might be because they're putting them in whole, but I doubt that's the reason. So there is the food revolution, and there is clearly a group of people who are massively committed to it, but there is also still the other end of the conversation.
So before we get into some of those numbers and some of the detail of what exactly people are doing, Carolyn, do you mind just sort of reprising what you are describing as the industrialisation of food? What actually does that mean? And when for you did that start? And I'm obviously talking about UK specifically.
I mean, I think really you could say, I mean, its roots lie in the agricultural revolution of the 17th and 18th centuries, and then obviously the industrial revolution, specifically land enclosure. So, I mean, if you think before the industrial revolution, most people lived on a farm and they fed themselves by growing stuff out the back. With the industrial revolution, which of course happened first in this country, people were forcibly moved off the land and into cities to work in the factories, and the land was then enclosed and transformed in order to feed the cities. So this is a massive rupture that I think we often underestimate the power of this. I mean, when people, I travel around the world and people kind of go to me, why do you eat so badly in the UK? They kind of say, well, we left the countryside 250 years ago, you know, and where does food come from? The countryside. So I think that was the beginning. But interestingly, in the 20th century, it's really the United States that kind of takes over the mantle of sort of really making sure we have horrible food, exactly. But I mean, if you think about what railways do, I mean, they open up vast tracts of land that would have otherwise been inaccessible. So, you know, the Great American Midwest goes from grassland to grain production. There's a massive grain glut. You know, suddenly the railways make it possible to bring all of this grain into cities like Chicago, where there's far too much of it. So they come up with a brilliant idea of feeding it to cattle. And of course, that's the beginning of industrial meat, i.e. cheap meat, and, you know, which of course is now global. I mean, something like 97% of meat globally is produced, you know, in that way and intensively reared on grain that we could otherwise be eating. So And also what you get very, very interestingly with the development of this kind of large scale, invisible, commodified way of producing food is obviously that people can't see where their food's coming from anymore. And there's a lot of fear around that, which is very interesting.
Fear in terms of they're worried about the safety of it, or just fear in that they can't actually cook food because they don't actually, they've completely don't understand food, full stop.
As Norman Schwarzkopf famously once said, all of the above. Right. So all of these phenomena happen together. But absolutely, I mean, it's absolutely fascinating if you read, for example, Paradox of Plenty, Harvey Levenstein's brilliant book about the evolution of American food culture in the 20th century. He talks about the fact that, you know, people start travelling to work. Then, I mean, it's extraordinary, a statistic that, you know, back in pre-war days in the UK, 50% of workers used to go home for lunch. You know, so when that sort of stops, so when people stop going home for lunch and they actually start going to these diners, which happens earlier in America because the distances are bigger, they just simply don't trust the food because they're used to it being cooked by their wives or whatever. You know, so they will only eat, they had restaurants in the United States where they would only eat canned soup. And you went to a counter and there was a sort of display of different kinds of flavours of canned soup and you picked your flavour and they opened the can in front of you and then heated it up for you. You know, so it's really fascinating.
So there's distrust there already.
There's distrust. I mean, also there was this amazing expose of the Chicago, the stockyards in 1906, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, which exposed the horrific conditions under which the animals were being slaughtered. And that's fascinating as well, because that led to a massive reduction in the eating of meat, a bit like sort of, you know, the antecedent of Horsegate, if you like. And the food industry panicked. And they had an absolutely fascinating response to this, which was to set up a series of hamburger joints called the White Castle and the White Tower, which were white, as it says in the title. So
that's all pure and
virginal and
all clean, that stuff.
Exactly.
Clean, yeah.
And they explicitly went for what I call the wildebeest approach of safety. In other words, there were lots of them. They smart bombed into cities. And all the advertising was about scale. So it was all about when you eat in a white tower, you are eating the same beef from the same plate, sitting on the same chair as thousands of other people. You know, so safe, it must be safe because there's lots of us.
Yeah.
You know, because if, as I say, if you're 500,000 wildebeest and going across a crocodile infested river, you
hopefully
hope
it's
that,
not you.
Exactly. So, you know, and one other thing I think is absolutely fascinating is with industrialization, I mean, George Orwell wrote this fantastic book, The Road to Wigan Pier, in which he travelled around the north of England looking at sort of just, I mean, doing a sort of, you know, an ollie, actually, kind of just, you know, finding out how people lived and asking them what their attitudes were. And what he found was that people preferred the taste of tinned food to fresh food because that's all they'd ever eaten. Mm. And, of course, we found this with Jamie Oliver, you know, when he did his schools programme. You know, and he, I remember the brilliant scene where he took all the kids to a strawberry patch because he thought they were going to just, you know, go wild for the taste of a freshly picked strawberry. And they were going yuck and spitting it out because they'd never had a fresh strawberry before.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So there are so many phenomena that are interlinked to do with distance, lack of skill, lack of awareness, fear. You know, they all come together in this great morass.
So there's some stats that Ollie has, which we're going to go on to in a minute, in terms of processed foods. My view of processed foods is probably from my childhood. So my parents brought up during the war. Then there was rationing, probably the healthiest the country's ever been. And then in the 70s, it was my food that I was brought up with was dreadful. I mean, I can't remember many fresh stuff because people didn't really do it. You just weren't expected to. So it was the era of Pop-Tarts and, you know, Vesta curries well, I mean, absolutely dreadful. Is that what people still think of as processed now? There's still quite a lot of over-processed food? Or
I mean, I think
necessarily processed food.
What you're referring to there is the next level up. So, I mean, this is, again, another fascinating evolution that happened in the United States in the 20th century. Was, you know, the fact that housewives were going out to work, but actually cultural norms didn't catch up with that fact very quickly. So women were still expected to cook a home-cooked meal in the evening, having done, you know, been out in the office all day. And, of course, they couldn't. So to sort of plug this market, you began to see the evolution of ready meals. And I mean, brilliantly, they were sort of, well, brilliantly, if you're trying to flog the things, they were sort of sold as you can sort of shove this in the oven and pretend to your husband you've cooked it yourself, you know. And that was the whole, that was, you know, that was the whole way they were marketed. And, you know, I think there's you know, we live with various levels of cognitive dissonance when it comes to food, you know, and I think we still haven't lost. And by the way, I mean, the ideal family meal, the Bisto family, if you like, where, you know, mum's kind of grinningly putting this delicious food on the table, etc. You know, that's a bit of a myth, to be perfectly honest. I mean, you know, if you think about it, you know, it's the woman has always been in a conflicted place in the household in terms of being expected to be the cook and the background skiff. I mean, this all comes out of the First World War, and actually the fact that the working population who used to, I mean, most middle class households in the 19th century would have had at least one household servant, and of course the servant classes were all decimated in the First World War, and that all changed, and you get the crisis of the servantless household.
Oh dear, what are we going to do? Yeah.
Oh dear, what are we going to do?
And of course, we're going to run around cooking up.
What we're going to do is Betty Crocker's going to do it for us, basically.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, again, and we haven't really ever worked through all of that stuff, you know, because I mean that the position of the housewife is a paradoxical one.
Yes,
you know,
of course.
She's meant to be the servant in the background, but she's also meant to sit down and be part of the family
and earn a living.
And also have a career these days.
Yeah. Indeed, yeah.
So leading on from that then, Ollie, you've done some research here on government intervention on safety. So one of the key questions here that you've asked is, you know, should the government be intervening on food safety because of some of the scandals that have happened in the past, of which Caroline's mentioned a little bit? What's coming out on the research for that?
So what's interesting is that, and again, this is a question we'd never asked, right? So
yeah, it's the first time you've asked this one. Yeah.
And I think we didn't know where the number would end up. And what you end up with is that 70% of people agree with the idea the government should do more to ensure food in the UK is safe.
That's a lot of people. I mean,
I think it's a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm slightly amazed. It's not 100%, frankly.
Really?
Because, well, who else is going to do it?
Well, is it the government? I don't know. Is it,
well, I think they have to put in.
Don't people think the supermarkets are gatekeepers somehow?
And the producers themselves, or the manufacturers, or the distributors, and the retailers, yeah.
But that's self-regulating, isn't it?
Mm.
That hasn't really worked.
No, and there's a long history of it not working.
And have you got some stuff there? I think you have, about avoiding processed foods, which hasn't really come up before as much. But given the background now and some of the stories that we're having, have you seen an increase in that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, 43% of people are saying they tend to stay away from processed or prepared food. So, I mean, that's a sizable chunk of the country. Mm. And I think, as you say, there are huge tensions around this, which is people are working longer hours. You know, everyone says, you know, there's always this narrative, I think, in the food world, which is people want things quick and easy. You know, Jamie Oliver, you know, 20-minute meals. You know, this whole narrative that things can be done quickly. But actually, I think, while, yes, people are time poor, and yes, people don't want to do things in the most complicated way possible, the reality is there is now a lack of trust with large food companies, and therefore people don't quite know what's in things. And, you know, when stuff lasts forever, and this whole counterweight to the revolution that we've had, where everything was kind of going to be wonderful and arrive instead of, you know, plastic.
But
packaging.
Is that because then that people used to assume that there are a whole bunch of people at different layers looking out for you, and therefore the big corporations would make sure it was all safe and okay and traceable, but it's okay because the supermarkets were doing that as well, and then, you know, the producers themselves are self-regulating, and therefore by the time it gets to you, you know, you've got a three-way split, everybody's looking after you, and suddenly that bubble's been pricked.
I think the bubble's been, there's massively burst, you know. Karen, you can probably trace it much better than I can, but I'm not sure there's trust anywhere on these sorts of questions. You know, do we trust supermarkets? Do we trust producers? You know, and that's where ultimately brand becomes so important, that you have to, a brand or people is who do you trust? You know, you trust when your family make you a meal, they've done their best, hopefully, to make it delicious and healthy and the rest of it. But
that isn't happening as often.
Safe's a big question.
Mm. I mean, you've just hit the nail on the head, brand. So what's very, these are all so complicated stories, and that you can trace them back so interestingly. But I would say that, again, one of the things we've never really bottomed out is who is responsible for making sure our food's safe. So, I mean, if you go back...
I think that's what I'm trying to say.
300 years, you know, it was the city authorities, you know, because they had to, because actually there wasn't a food industry at that point. So they had to organise, you know, make... I mean, the fact that you had to buy and sell food in an open space in the middle of the city visibly was all to do with making sure that nobody was cheating and nobody was adulterating. And you had inspectors going around sort of monitoring. Of course, there was all sorts of dirty dealings going on the whole time because you can't control food. But, you know, they tried. Nevertheless, it was their responsibility. And I think the big shift that happens with industrialisation is that the implication is that the food industry is going to do it instead. And I think that's why it was so shocking when, you know, this book, The Jungle, came out that I mentioned. You know, it was, ooh, we trusted them, but they're not doing the job. And that's when the companies themselves respond by trying to reassure customers that they do really care. And so, yes, I mean, that the job of advertising then becomes, as I mentioned with White Tower and White Castle, you know, reassuring people. But actually, they have no constitutional responsibility. As long as what they don't do is criminal, they don't have a sort of duty of care.
But
actually,
they lie, though, Carolyn.
I know they
That's
lie.
That's my issue, yeah. Is that they lie.
Yes.
You know, so you have little pictures and photographs of some man in a field holding a chicken, which if he doesn't even... he's
That comes down to marketing and advertising.
But it's interesting to me. If you look at the statement around the government doing more, it is more strongly felt that the government should do more amongst the young than the old.
Really?
So it's 73% amongst the under 25s, and it's 60% amongst the over 65s.
That's really interesting.
That is interesting.
I mean, I think again, don't forget the war. I mean, the war was a really interesting time when the government really did take control of food. There was a Ministry of Food.
That's right. Yeah.
And the government controlled everything that was eaten. And I think the older generation sort of, they learnt to trust food again during the war because actually it was being controlled by the government.
Because the government wanted you to be fit and well so you can go out and fight and look after everybody or whatever. So and by they the had way, a vested interest in their citizens in a way they probably don't now.
Yes.
But they should have now. I mean, why not?
Yeah, they absolutely should.
Want people to be fit and healthy and, you know, working and looking after their families. And
but they're terrified of it because nobody likes being told what to eat.
It's the nanny state.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is, if we can actually make Britain as a country eat more healthily, it will have huge repercussions in terms of increased productivity, less cost to the NHS. I mean, it's the simplest thing we could do to make this country work better.
I agree with you. I mean, I think we should have a Ministry of Food. I really do. And a Minister of Food.
Not quite sure what minister it would be, though. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's true. We need new ministers.
Yeah, and it would go, wouldn't it? He goes jogging. Go. He must be fine.
Please don't. So I'm just going to delve back into the figures here, though, Ollie. So, interestingly, it's the statement that you've asked is, do you agree with the statement the government should do more to ensure food in the UK is safe? Now, and again, in your research, what it says is the view increases amongst women. Probably one might expect that, you know, particularly if they're mums, possibly. But also, it's interesting to note that socioeconomic groups D&E, so people who are perhaps somewhat further down the sort of salary ladder, actually agree with this statement far more strongly than people with more money. So do you find that surprising, Carol?
So D, just to be clear, that's housewife or homemaker or unemployed.
Yeah.
They're grouped together.
Yeah. So 74% of those people think it's more important than ABs, which were at 65%.
Well, I mean, as ever with food, we're getting into these fascinating, enormous sort of paradoxes. So here what we're encountering is the market versus the state question, you know. The whole way that British, another great fascinating thing about Britain is that it's an island and it used to have an empire. And before it had an empire, it was part of another empire called the Roman Empire. And we've been importing food from overseas forever. So we have what I call a free trade attitude to food.
So and in a way that some of the countries haven't had that history.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Well, I mean, the classic comparison is with France, which had a protectionist idea. Mm. And in fact, the leading economists of their day during leading up to the French Revolution were arguing for complete protectionism because it was a very, very strong agrarian economy in France. Whereas Adam Smith, of course, at precisely the same time is arguing the exact opposite and saying that's limited.
So and interestingly, those views still exist, don't they?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, you can understand everything through food.
but the French attitude to that is around protectionism, and we don't really understand that, and they don't understand us.
That's right.
But it's historical.
It's historical and it's geographical. Mm. You know, it's to do with how you feed yourself and where the food comes from.
Mm. But I think what's interesting as well is there is potentially a movement amongst these people who are caring more about food to actually wanting to be
more government intervention,
and also more closely in control of what's happening to stuff. And I think going back to that thing around the difference between the younger audience, who are kind of agree with the statement more strongly than the older, I think the other thing is the younger audience have different expectations.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, if you're 25 or sub 35, you've actually grown up through the food revolution of the last 10 years.
Yes.
You expect certain things to be certain ways.
Yeah.
And you're not cool with what was happening in your parents' day in terms of the way food was produced. Mm. So I think you're beginning also to see those two different generations, more than generations, but two massive blocks of people kind of now living out their kind of their different views of food.
But I find it extraordinary that in general people are very, very cynical about politics and politicians and government, and we're seeing that around the world. There's been seismic shifts in that in the last 2 years. And yet, even so, people are going, You are my guardian of last resort. I really need you as a government. Please will you step in and do this.
But only on this particular issue, according to this particular research.
I agree.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to ask similar kinds of political questions across the board.
Yeah.
But I bet if you ask the question, do you think the government should be doing more to make the internet safe for your children, you would have an even higher number.
Mm. Yeah.
So I think there are certain elements of societal interaction where I think we all feel it's completely out of our control.
Yeah.
And or at least there isn't a sensible way of us controlling it, unless you sort of shut down the internet and grow everything from scratch.
Yeah.
And therefore, you do need government intervention.
And there's a complete difference between, you know, the people who, shall we say, are now squabbling over Brexit and government, government as a big idea. You know, I mean, the minions in some faceless building on Whitehall who are actually doing proper work. I never got round to...
I love it when you're here, because you just don't really mince your words, do you?
But I was going to, I never quite got round to addressing your point about the D&Es and why they want more.
Sorry.
The obvious thing is they don't have the market choice. So if you're an A, B or a C, you can say, oh, well, I just shop at Waitrose.
I'll
self-select
because I can.
I'll just get an organic box.
I've got the power to do so.
Exactly.
Interestingly, we'll lead on to Brexit as well now. One of the questions you did ask, Ollie, is what do you think the impact of Brexit is going to be on food prices? And amongst committed foodies, this increases to over 70% think that there's going to be an impact amongst our foodie people. But home cooks, so that's people who probably aren't as engaged in cooking food from scratch, believes it's going to be less than 50% believe it'll have an impact. So is it because everybody's bored of Brexit, or they don't understand, or it hasn't hit us yet, or what's the stats telling us?
Think you can read these stats on who voted for Brexit and who didn't.
Right, okay.
Because I think when you look at the younger audience, you can see that actually they're much more concerned about it. The female audience is more concerned than the male audience. You know, the older audience is less concerned about it. Now, the committed foodies, because they happen to spend a significant amount of their disposable income on food, and let's remember, foodies are not ABs, they are people who make economic choices with a lens of food, actually, they are worried, because truth be told, they want still to be receiving the sort of the stuff that's coming in from all over the world, and are frankly terrified by the idea that, you know, the things they love, the things they rely upon, which are not grown in this country, suddenly could vanish. It's a passion point for them. So I think you're seeing there also a kind of a...
But don't you think our food is artificially cheap over here? So when I went to America, I was stunned over Christmas. The food is really expensive. But, you know, maybe that makes you treat it differently and appreciate it differently. No, not on the West Coast.
It's the cheapest of anywhere in the world compared to
capital expenditure. It's really, really, really expensive. Well, I found it expensive and I was shocked, actually, and I don't even really notice.
Eating, I guess.
Yeah.
If you go to all the fancy places.
No, this is just the local shops.
It's interesting. So on the price thing, so we asked the question, to what extent are you happy to pay extra for quality food products? And we've seen a 6% rise in the number of people who agree with the statement they're happy about that. So I think people are beginning to twig with the idea that there is a direct correlation between quality and price.
Because our food is artificially cheap, isn't it?
Mm.
Don't you think, Carolyn?
Yes.
And actually, or might be cheap when you pay for it.
Horn going off.
It may be cheap when you're paying for it. Yeah. Actually, there's all sorts of knock-on effects by having cheap food, and that affects health and it affects karma. I mean, the cost.
There are massive externalities.
Cheap food is very, very expensive.
You just have to go back and look at. I mean, yes, there are efficiencies of scale, so called, but you have to look at what those are at the cost of.
Sure.
And I mean, there's a very famous study done by the India, an Indian environmental science laboratory about 20 years ago. That reckoned then that, you know, if you paid the true cost of a hamburger made from beef, made from land recently cleared of rainforest, you know, in order to provide the grazing, it should cost $200 and not two. So not only do we externalise the cost, for example, like sort of food-related illnesses, type 2 diabetes, obesity, climate change, pollution, loss of soil fertility, but also we subsidise food directly, you know. So it's a double whammy. And, you know, the result is that artisanal organic food appears to be really expensive, whereas you could argue that actually that's the only food that's produced where you're paying the true cost. Yeah. And actually, because there are no externalities, it's really cheap.
And do you think that people are twigging on that then, Ollie? Is that what you believe?
I think they're beginning to understand that they want to make a choice where they are prepared to pay for quality. I think that's what you're seeing, which is people are sort of going, no, I'm, you know, I don't
think it's quality. I think it's authenticity. That's what I'm prepared to pay for. Not
quality. By quality, I mean, I think it's...
whatever you value.
I think it's more than just, it's a better piece of chicken or it's a better, you know, strawberry. Yeah. It's quality. And I think that means about production methodology. I think that's about quality of taste. You know,
the ethics and the whole sustainability of the production as well. I mean, it's not something that we have a huge amount of data on ourselves at the moment, but it's, you know, a big trend that we're seeing in a lot of the content that we're producing and the people that we're talking to. You know, people they're starting to vote much more with their wallet, and, you know, make decisions based on the things that they believe in and value. And I think that has a huge part to play in it.
And fundamentally, you know, one of the biggest things we discovered, you know, when we did this first research in 2017 was, foodies are not ABC1. You know, when you look at ABC1s, they are no more likely to be
get rid of that ridiculous misconception.
The truth is, if you're into food, you're into food. And therefore you're going to make an economic choice. And the truth is, spending an extra 50p or an extra £2 on something is a choice you can make. You know, iPhones cost £1,000, you know, so it's a choice you can make on those things. Not for everyone, let's be clear, but within a certain group of society, absolutely it is.
And we've been talking about this number of people saying that they're actively trying to avoid processed foods. Now, you were actually saying in your research that this is leading to significant groups of people embracing the DIY revolution and also making things from scratch. An impressive number of Brits have made bread, 29%. Cocktails, 23%, jam, 15% in the last 12 months. And there's also people who are making their own ketchup, and they're preserving fruit, and there's a lot of that. Now, that is a trend that is completely different from maybe 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, and I think it's driven by two things. I think one is about that desire for quality and the desire for a certain thing. But I also think it's fun. You know, a lot of us spend our time tapping away on computers. We have very, you know, untactile lives. And it's tremendous fun to come home and to make a meal, even if it only takes you half an hour, even if it, you know, on a weekend, you know, making a cake, whatever it happens to be, actually people really enjoy it. It's nice to be able to say, oh, I made this. And it's just much more interesting, you know.
And do you think, Caroline, that people are doing that but because of the food safety thing, as well as, you know, knowing where everything is coming from, as well as doing it for, in inverted commas, entertainment?
Yes, I mean, again, it's another of these all of the above answers. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I really think that's a fascinating stat that 29% of people have made their own bread in the last year. I mean, and I'm very encouraged.
Have you done that?
Yes.
No. Oh, well done.
No, I live on my own rye bread.
Very good.
It's, likewise. I adore, we're a self-selecting group here. I mean, if you can't tick all 10 of these boxes, you don't deserve to be on this programme.
Shouldn't be on the show.
This is actually one of the most interesting stats we got, which I hadn't shared, which we've been careful about, is we did also ask about what percentage of people, that we named various chefs and food personalities. So what percentage of the UK do you think have heard of Yotam Ottolenghi?
Mm. Oh,
40%?
I would have thought it was lower than that. Right. Of the UK?
I'm going for the bread number, 30.
I'll go 20.
10.
10%? Okay.
This is what's interesting. Yeah. Is that this is your self-selecting point,
yes,
right?
Yes,
which is,
yes.
You know, if you live in North London, you know, and you go to Otto Lengi and you have all his cookbooks, you assume everyone's heard of him. Mm-hmm. And this is partially one of the challenges. This is one of the reasons we put data behind this stuff, is that one has to get those personal opinions out of this stuff try and actually get back to what's actually happening.
I think it's fascinating. It's brilliant that you've done this. I really do.
And it's the trends, of course, which I absolutely love. So we're seeing that people are avoiding processed food. They do feel that the government should intervene on their behalf. I feel quite strongly about that. There's lots of other food avoidance going on, as I call it. So people, you know, perhaps not eating meat as much as normal, or trying to have more plant-based food in the diet, or, you know, choosing, and I'm not talking about this for health reasons, but choosing to maybe be a bit more gluten-free. That's across all of your results, isn't it?
It is. We were quite careful about how we worded these things. So it was about, you know, which of the statements do you agree with? I am a vegan. Agree or disagree? So we were trying to pull out, make sure that the guys of this world who are part-time vegans or part-time vegetarians or, you know, afternoon dairy intolerance, you know, actually we're trying to get to those core things. And I think what's interesting is actually 75% of the UK basically say they kind of eat everything. But there is then this other group of people who are clearly on the rise, because their numbers have moved since our 2017 data, where you are seeing rise in the number of vegans, vegetarians, people who are avoiding meat. Now, again, the research was done in January, so we're going to rerun this.
Flexible?
So the flexitarian thing is massively on the rise. And again, I think when I first heard this term 3 years ago, I'm like, that's never going to catch on.
Flexitarian?
Yeah, I mean,
really?
Yeah.
I don't like the term, and that's why I don't use it to describe myself, but it's definitely, it's, you know, People are always looking for a label that they can say, oh yeah, this is what I associate with.
Or explains,
yeah, that it, you know, explains it in a word rather than, you know.
I mean, I guess I am really. Program. You know, a couple of days a week, try and be really sort of careful or whatever, and maybe that's now given it a label, whereas it didn't have one before. Yeah.
Can I introduce yet another vast phenomenon that this taps into? We are coded, if you like, to eat the same as other people. You know, so if you go back in history. You know, a family would have sat down and they would have eaten the same food, you know, at the same time. And so if you go back, really, you know, 10,000 years, so would the tribe, if you like.
That's all you had, so get on with it, really.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Now we live in this really terrifying era where A, you don't trust your food, B, you don't know where it comes from, C, half of it's destroying the planet, and D, you know, you're worried about your own body, because, I mean, research is coming out every week about the microbiome and all this stuff. It's so complicated. So if you label something, you know, it's very interesting that we've got these food gurus emerging. I mean, clean eating, for example, many of whom have actually had, you know, food disorders, and they've kind of come out the other side and said, I eat like this. And people just, they're drawn to this kind of idea, because it's, I'll be part of that tribe. You know, I'll eat as this other person eats, or this is the label according to which.
But why is somebody doing that? Are they doing it because it's like, well, she's more intelligent than me, or beautiful, or thin, or whatever, and therefore, well, it works for them, so yeah, it'd probably be fine for me. You know, is there a bit of that going on?
Yes, but I mean, if you think about it.
Because then
the way,
I don't have to make my judgments myself. I've got somebody else who's done it for me.
But I mean, think about how food culture works. I mean, you know, we, as babies, we didn't look at our mother's teeth and kind of go, ooh, not sure about this. You know, you are introduced to food and you eat it. And that's how you learn what's edible and not edible. And this is, and this is what we sort of are losing. And it's very terrifying to be in a world where, you know, your mother never cooked for you, really, and you just got shoved things stuck in a microwave. So, you know, it's about identity, but it's also about sort of, identity.
For me, it's
about
identity.
It's a huge thing.
That, for me, is the thing which is really interesting.
Yeah, but it's not the only thing.
No, it's not. But I think certainly when you look at the sort of the growth of veganism and vegetarianism, pescatarianism, and avoiding a whole load of stuff amongst a younger audience who are, earlier on in their period of self-definition, are picking these groups to say, I am part of that tribe. Mm. And how much difference is there to, you know, I'm into this band versus that band, or I'm into this fashion, you know, I'm a goth or I'm not a goth, you know. I mean, like, you know,
Chelsea, Arsenal.
Tottenham
Hotspur,
Arsenal the other day. Great fun.
Yeah. You know, but what you're saying is, I hadn't really thought of it as identity.
I think it is.
No,
I think there's a lot of it that is to do with identity. Massively. And, you know, you fit, you're sort of part of that group. I mean, one of the ones that for me came through, which again, gave me quite a lot of heart, was the statement, I avoid sugar where possible. Is at 45%. And it's highest above ABs, and it's highest above older audiences.
Did you eat fat?
We, do you know, we did last time, actually. We didn't this time, annoyingly. But we've got meat and we've got, I'm trying to follow more plant-based diets.
Yeah.
So we, Ken Smith's ones, where you covered it from lots of different angles.
I know, because fat and sugar are sort of on a seesaw, basically. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, and as
up
we
against
know...
against each other, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, one of the things we haven't done, Sue, which was one of your ideas, which we need to segment on, was looking at how it differs by big city, small city, and rural. And actually, I think that's quite interesting as well. I mean, this is what's such fun about this kind of data is, you sort of go, let's go away and work out what happens if you cut it on.
50 different
ways. I should give you my favourite one. So we have cut it based on people who self-identify as Jedis.
Well done.
And the exciting statistic we discovered is that 38% of Jedis own blowtorches.
There you go.
Of course they do.
Of course they do.
And they set off fireworks in the garden, I mean.
Yeah. Well, we're going to cover the use of kitchen tools and the stats for that next week. So we won't go into that, but we will cover that next week.
We'll bring in some more Jedi.
We will. One of my favourite things in the research, which I feel so heartened by, because actually this research is heartening for me. It feels like people are taking more ownership and making their voices heard about food more, so in general, which I feel quite heartened by it. But one of them is that the local butcher, the local baker, the local fishmonger is becoming more important, and more people are shopping there if they have that on their doorstep. And that's a great one. The fishmonger research I thought was really interesting in particular.
I mean, I think it's great. I mean, I think, you know, we've all lived through the various meat crises of the last few years. And I think there is increasingly a desire, and we come back to the conversation of trust, be able to walk in and, you know, there's a butcher I go to and, you know, he's totally like, hey, what's going on?
You can have a real conversation.
You have a conversation, yeah. And you say, which farm did this come from? And he doesn't show you a picture he pulled off clip art. He actually says, oh, it came from this week, the chickens from here, or the beef from here. And I think people like that. And I wonder if part of it comes back to a desire for connection as well, totally, which is, you know,
so it's not so depersonalised when you wander around supermarkets. It's very depersonalised, isn't it?
Hugely, yeah.
But also you need the skill to go to a shop like that. I mean, that's what's really interesting. So, for example, I remember going shopping with my grandmother and she'd kind of go into the butcher's, sort of sweeping in like Queen Victoria, kind of going, you know, I need some brisket, what it's like today. And, oh, that looks, doesn't look right at all. And, you know, this kind of, well, anyway, it's very embarrassing shopping with my grandmother. But, you know, this idea that it's an equal encounter, and if you're a bit unsure of your own skill and stuff, it's quite, it's easier to just go and grab a plastic tray off a supermarket shelf and have this kind of encounter. So, but I mean, it's also symptomatic, the fact that people are using these kinds of shop more.
But interestingly, I think the reverse of that might well be true, in that they're not sashaying in because they know a lot about it. What they're doing is they're going in and saying, can you help me? I don't know how to do this.
Yes, and I'm sure that's
and maybe
right.
That's, you know, that's changed a bit, which is good, because we're looking at these guys as people who can help us prepare and cook food.
Anecdotally, I met a butcher who in a northern market town a couple of years ago, and he said what was really interesting is that the people that used his shop were old people and young people. So basically there was a kind of missing generation. But the oldsters knew, because they knew their stuff, and the youngsters were coming in, as you rightly say, and going, I've only got 50p, what can I eat?
The number of times I'm in my fishmonger or my local butcher and someone says, what's that? How do you cook it?
I'm happy to say that.
And quite happy to, and Bob, because they're like, you know, and actually they get a really good answer. Often, you know, there's the conversation, oh, he works at a great British Chef, you should ask him. Which I'm like, damn, you need to go undercover.
Don't ask him.
You know, don't ask me. But actually, you know, what's nice is then there's often a conversation amongst, you know, the customers there saying, oh, how do you cook that? What do you, and I think that's also
that's
nice, because
nice
when you're into food, you want to share that passion. Yes. So being able to say, oh, well, I always cook it this way.
So if we look at the figures here, amongst committed foodies, 27% say that they often shop at fishmongers. I mean, that's a lot. And 46% say occasionally. Now, fishmongers have been absolutely wiped off the high street. And actually, where I live now, we've got a fishmonger's back and it is packed. People love it and they go and buy stuff and it looks amazingly fresh. The supermarkets are really poor at fish. And when I go in and look at fish, the quality of it is dreadful and it isn't fresh. So many times it's filleted because actually they daren't leave the head on because it's way past its best. And we're ill served, I think, by supermarkets. Waitrose probably just about the only one who's half decent with fish, but most of them's dreadful. Dreadful.
I think it's one of those things where, you know, if you walk into a great retail experience in any sector, you know, you sell the product. I don't think I've ever walked into a fishmonger's in the UK in a large supermarket and felt the sea, felt the sense of passion, felt the idea that people there really knew and were passionate about their product. You walk into, you know, Moxon's, in my local fishmonger in Islington, and, you know, the guys absolutely know what they're doing. There's lots of chat about what's in, lots of chat about what's fresh. Try this. They give you a bit of stuff to try it. And all that sort of interaction is what builds loyalty. And also it's about experimentation. Absolutely. And for foodies, I think in particular, we want to discover new stuff. And therefore, when you've got someone prepared to engage you in that, you're in a good place.
But, you know, a lot of people say that British people don't eat fish, which is weird because we're an island surrounded by the sea, but actually we're big meat eaters. But actually in your research here, nationally, we're saying, when you say, which of the following do you eat? And we got fish. 91% saying they're eating fish either regularly or occasionally. So we do eat fish.
Interesting, it's an older generation. So there's a real issue amongst inspiring the younger generation to eat fish. So the younger groups are slightly more scared of fish. Well, that's an assumption.
Scared
they
of preparing
they don't
cooking
cook fish as much as the older generation. The older generation are very much in the kind of fish Fridays kind of camp and are much more like, oh, I always have trout, I always have salmon. And there's a bit more rhythm to it and an understanding that you should eat a certain number of portions of fish a week from a kind of developmental perspective and stuff as well for kids.
But younger people are happy to eat sushi or they'll eat fish in other
ways. Yeah, so I think they're picking up there, but I think they're less, interestingly, we're seeing them less into fish than the older generation. Mm. So there is a challenge for the fish industry to actually reignite that younger
audience. I wonder how much of that is also about all the things that we've been hearing about, you know, fishing is no longer sustainable, you know, we're killing the oceans. And if the younger generation are the ones who are perhaps more swayed towards that way of, you know, thinking and getting on board with that kind of thing, maybe they're avoiding fish as a way to kind of support the environmental side.
Yeah.
By the way, I think it's the knowledge thing again, because it's actually shellfish that we don't eat. You know, so we have amazing, you know, crayfish and mussels and oysters and all sorts of things. And actually the vast majority of them get exported to Europe. Mm. So I think it's things that you have to slightly know what to do with that we don't go for. And actually, certainly my parents' generation, it was the slab of cod or the slab of salmon rather than something
shellfish.
You have to sort of winkle out.
Yeah, really I can understand that.
Cockles.
Yeah, so seafood is 30% regularly versus fish that's 45% regularly.
Yeah, so it's not huge difference.
But it's 20%. But again, you're back in that slightly more foodie audience who are prepared to tackle it.
And overall, Carolyn, again, are you pleased I don't know, just got a bit of hope for the future that somehow butchers, bakers, fishmongers, these individual people are beginning to come back into our town and you know, centres and whatever, and being valued?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. And this is so important. And yes, I am very heartened by these statistics and slightly surprised by them, actually, because the numbers are definitely higher for some of the things that I would have expected. But I mean, of course, you know, you can't have local butchers, bakers and candlestick makers unless you have people who are prepared to, you know, to be at home and to do, you know, go to the shop, have the conversation, come home and cook. And it's got to go this way. It's absolutely got to go this way because, you know, the industrial model is just sending the planet off a cliff, basically.
And I do feel that people are beginning to understand that food can be the centre of your community in all sorts of ways, you know, buying it, selling it. Eating out, you know, in your community.
There's always been this deep irony for me that, you know, English people go, or British people go abroad, and the first thing they do, they go to France and they go to the market and buy some cheese, and it was lovely, we're on holiday, we're doing this. And then they come back and they go back to, you know, Tesco's. And you sort of think, that's weird, you could actually do that at home as well, but it's almost like something you only do on holiday. And I think that is shifting, and certainly the statistics you're coming up with really seem to support that. And you know, for me, I mean, this is a very necessary revolution, and I'm slightly surprised at the speed with which it's going. But, you know, we've been to a very bad place, a dark place, you know. And so I think the rebound was bound to happen. But I think many other things are feeding into it now.
I just hope that the supermarkets and some of the other big multinationals don't feel, you know, that they then have to come up with some sort of strategy where that bombs all that again.
But the interesting thing I think is that the way that people are shopping supermarkets, I think, is changing, and the way people are shopping food is changing. So if you look at this, the number of people who are still shopping supermarkets hasn't changed. People are still shopping supermarkets regularly. So it's not like people aren't going there.
That's where I get my shopping powder, my washing powder. Exactly. I get my food there.
But and that's what's changing, I think, is, right. You know, people are doing more online. They're doing more, you know, still doing the same amount of supermarkets. But what they're doing is they're picking up specialist things, which, truth be told, are the high-value things. Mm. And for the retailers, often the high-margin things, actually in specialist stores. And that's the hope, which is, look, I'm cool with the fact that the supermarkets keep doing your Doves, your Purcells, your, you know, all that stuff. But actually, what you really want people to be doing is picking up their local cheese and local meats and fish elsewhere.
Mm. And then a final point, I can't believe we're coming to the end of the programme soon. Some stuff around takeaways. Now, we sort of were chatting earlier, Ollie, about takeaways being not just fast food, so that's one area of takeaway, but actually people more and more, particularly in city centres, going and getting food to take home in one way or another that's probably already hot or prepared for them, and then eating that at home. So there's a real range there. There's massive increases in that, isn't there, across the board?
There are, and I think the truth is that there has been a massive change in what a takeaway means in the UK. I mean, when I was growing up in the, you know, 70s, early 80s, the reality was takeaway meant going to McDonald's and taking your burger home with you.
Or fish and chips.
Yeah, or fish and chips, yeah. Exactly.
Or your curry, that's, or your Chinese, yeah. Or whatever, yeah.
But and that then followed, and then, you know, and then it kind of was the Chinese and the Indian local restaurant. But now, actually, you know, if you go on to the various sites you've got, particularly in major city centres, you've got a whole range of different stuff.
And you're getting restaurant quality food, exactly, delivered to your door. So, I mean, we were chatting earlier about how it's become more of a treat thing than it is like I need something fast and I don't care if it's nutritionally value or not. I mean, I don't even know how often it is, probably once a week, maybe, you know, once every other week or so, we'll use a service like Deliveroo or Uber Eats or something like that to get something that is good quality delivered where I don't have to do the cooking because I've had a long day or I just, you know, want a night off.
And Carolyn, with a background of you as a trained architect, do you think anything to do with the way houses are built now or houses and flats and apartments are structured?
That's a very important point, actually. I mean, I think, going back to this history of the conflicted place of the cook stroke housewife in the home, I mean, that was a major issue for 20th century feminists, and you know where the kitchen was and how it was placed and how easy it was to use was revolutionised in the 20th century, and we're now retreating from that position again, and we're sort of going to a place where actually a lot of people just don't cook, and of course there's great constrictions on space in cities now, and people are literally building apartments where there is no kitchen, which I think is, to me, is absolutely, it's criminal. I would even go as far as to call it criminal.
But there might be somewhere that you can eat communally, but not cook.
Well, and of course, that wouldn't be for the first time. So I mentioned the servantless home crisis. Mm. Actually, that's precisely when serviced flats were built, and they still exist in London. In fact, there's one near me, which, you know, has a food court in the basement, and the residents just went down and literally I mean, it's extraordinary. So, but I think it's very short-sighted because I think, you know, for me, the ability to choose what you eat, to have control over it, as Ollie said earlier on, simply the pleasure of cooking is such a fundamental part of a good life. And as life gets more and more, you know, fast-paced and sort of digital, as it were, food is a sort of necessary counteraction to that, I think. So it's very short-sighted. And by the way, I have to say, some of these delivery things, I mean, they pretend they come from a proper restaurant, but actually they're cooked in porter cabins underneath flyovers, you know. Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of dodgy.
Don't you love having Carolyn as a guest? Keeps me grounded. Well, no, you can't have another subject topic because we're running out of time. Sorry. I'm so sorry, but we have run out of time. When can we access this research, Ollie?
So if you go onto greatbritishchefs.com/insight, you will basically find all of the reports we've written, and this is our 2018.
We've only just scratched the surface at the moment. We've got another programme next week where we're going to go into looking at the actual types of food that people are eating, the country cuisines and all that. So we're going to look at that side of it. But for the moment, I'm ever so sorry, you're going to have to stop this conversation. I could have Caroline Steele on this programme every week. It's nice and controversial. It makes me think as well.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for having me. And the research is absolutely fascinating. fascinating and heartening, as you say. So thanks.
Some of
so
it's
much
heartening.
For that.
I'm quite pleased with it. So you've been listening to the Food Talk show. Thank you so much to my guest Carolyn Steele, who's author of Hungry City. We're obviously waiting for her next book, Carolyn. I keep saying that.
Like her publisher.
Yeah, like her publisher is. It'll be another couple of years yet.
The pain.
Yes, because we keep distracting you and bringing you on this show. Thank you to my fellow presenters, Guy Routledge from Sapling Digital and co-founder of Food Rush. Thank you, Guy. It's great research, isn't
it? Yeah, it's fantastic. And more to dig into next week, which is great.
And thank you, Ollie, and your lovely team back at Great British Chefs. It's a really valuable piece of work, and I know it helps you in your business, but it's also helping lots of us too. So, so thanks for doing that. You can get in touch with us via Twitter on @FoodTalkShow, or if you want to listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts or find out any more about this information, please go to foodtalk.co.uk. Have a good week. Don't forget, you've only got a couple of days to enter the Food Talk Awards. Go on the website, get in there. It's worth doing. And we'll do some more of this research next week. Bye now.